Good morning, everyone.
Do any of you watch Stargate
SG-1?
There's one in the room. Basically, Stargate SG-1, it's about, you can travel through space, and what you do is you go through this gate. It's called a Stargate, or a Tabba Eye, we call it. And it looks like a pool of water, but if you go through it, in a few seconds' time, you're the other side of the universe. And anyway, there are two characters in this series. There's Jack O'Neill, who's a sort of Colonel Jack O'Neill, and there's Samantha Carter. Now, Samantha Carter is absolutely brilliant. You know, she saved the world hundreds of times just with her brain. You know, she's given a problem, you know, the Earth is under attack. She will save the world just because she's brilliant. And when it comes to computers, my wife here, she's Samantha Carter, and I'm Jack O'Neill. You know, I'd be very good shooting replicators and Gwald and that sort of thing, but I'm absolutely no good at computers. This lady here, she is absolutely brilliant. She's Samantha Carter of computers, and she actually builds computers, builds them. You can imagine such a clever clunk. And do that. And but we were talking about computers the other day, and she was talking about how she builds a computer. Now, apparently, to build a computer, you need a thing called a motherboard. Now, the motherboard is what everything else in the computer is attached to. You've got to understand the motherboard. If you don't understand that, and how everything attaches to it, it's not going to work. You're not going to have a computer. You may as well stick it in the skip. But so that is computer wise. Now, we have in our faith, obviously, when God created us, he created a motherboard, if you like, which is our Bible. Everything connects with the Bible, the fact that God is God, he created everything. That is our ultimate motherboard. Obviously, we're coming up to the time of year when we think about Jesus' sacrifice, the cross. As far as salvation goes, Jesus is the Son of God who died for your sins, for my sins. That is the motherboard of our salvation. But there's another motherboard as well in the scriptures, and that is the motherboard of prophecy. And I'm going to talk about that. There's one chapter in the Bible which is the motherboard of all prophecy. Now, I was on the internet the other day, and there was an American pastor talking. I think his name was Michael Hasler, that's right. His grandfather, however, served in the German army, and he was in Russia. In fact, he was in a bridge building unit which went, there were two, the Germans went in, basically went north to Moscow, and they went south to the Ukraine and round the Black, trying to get to the Caspian Sea. He was in a bridge building unit, which is extremely dangerous. Anybody who's served in the sappers or in the very dangerous work. And one day, his commanding officer brought him into his office and said, sit down, Hasler. And he said, do you think that we are going to win the war? Now, he's in a bit of a quandary, you know. Because the official answer is, of course we're going to win the war. Every time a German, lifted your arm and said, Sieg Heil, basically he was saying, of course I'm going to win. The word Sieg means victory. Sieg Heil, hail victory. Of course, basically every time they did that, it says, of course we're going to win, you dummy. Of course we're going to win. So he prayed about this for a split second, and then he said, are you asking me officially, or are you asking me unofficially? So they had an unwritten rule in the unit, and if you kept your hat on, it was official. If you took your hat off, you could say what you liked. So the commanding officer took his hat off. He took his hat off and said, "Right, do you think we're going to win this war?" And he said, "Do you mind if I get my Bible?" So when he got his Bible, and he opened it, Daniel 2, and that is what we're. So that's what we're going to be looking at mainly today, is Daniel 2. But during, I'll wait till it's up there. Daniel 2, verse 1. Ah, okay. During the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he had some dreams. He was troubled, but he stayed asleep. The king sent for the magicians, the psychics, the sorcerers, and astrologers so that they could tell him what he had dreamed. So they came to the king. The king said to them, "I had a dream, and I'm troubled by it. I want to know what the dream was." The astrologers spoke to the king in Aramaic, "Your Majesty, may you live forever. Tell us the dream, and we'll interpret it for you." The king answered the astrologers, "I meant what I said. If you don't tell me the dream and its meaning, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be turned into piles of rubble." You know, that's, I think, if it had been a Monday, that would have been the origin. You know, I hate Mondays, you know. "But if you tell me the dream and its meaning, I will give you gifts, awards, and high honours. Now, tell me the dream and its meaning." Once more they said, "Your Majesty, tell us the dream, and we will tell you its meaning." The king replied, "I'm sure you're trying to buy some time, because you know that I meant what I said. If you don't tell me the dream, you'll all receive the same punishment. You have agreed among yourselves to make up a phony explanation to give me, hoping that things will change. So, tell me the dream. Then I will know that you can explain its meaning to me." The astrologers answered to the king, "No one on earth can tell the king what he wants. No other king, no matter how great or powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician, psychic, or astrologer. What you ask is difficult, Your Majesty." Well, I think the word would be impossible, Your Majesty. "No one can tell what you dreamt except the gods, and they don't live with humans." This made the king so angry and furious that he gave an order to destroy all the wise advisers in Babylon. So a decree was issued that the wise advisers were to be killed, and some men were sent to find Daniel and his friends to kill them. While Arioch, the captain of the royal guard, was leaving to kill the royal advisers in Babylon, Daniel spoke to him using shrewd judgment. He asked Arioch, the royal official, "Why is the king's decree so hasty?" So Arioch explained everything to Daniel. Daniel went and asked the king to give him some time so that he could explain the dream's meaning. Then Daniel went home and told his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about this matter. He told them to ask the God of heaven to be merciful and to explain this secret to them so that they would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise advisers in Babylon. The secret was revealed to Daniel in a vision during the night. So Daniel praised the God of heaven. He said, "Praise God's name from everlasting to everlasting, because he is wise and powerful. He changes times and periods and history. He removes kings and he establishes them. He gives wisdom to those who are wise and knowledge to those who have insight. He reveals deeply hidden things. He knows what is in the dark, and light lives with him. God of my ancestors, I thank and I praise you. You gave me wisdom and power. You told me the answer to our question. You told us what the king wants to know. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy Babylon's wise advisers. Daniel told him, "Don't destroy Babylon's wise advisers. Take me to the king, and I will explain the dream to him and the meaning." Arioch immediately took Daniel to the king. He told the king, "I found one of the captives from Judah who can explain the dream's meaning to your majesty." The king asked Daniel, who had been renamed Belteshazzar, "Can you tell me the dream I had and its meaning?" Daniel answered the king, "No wise advisor, psychic, magician, or fortune teller can tell the king the secret. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. He will tell King Nebuchadnezzar what is going to happen days to come. This is your dream, the vision you had while you were asleep, your majesty. While you were lying in bed, thoughts about what would happen in the future came to you. The one who reveals secrets told you what is going to happen. The secret wasn't revealed to me because I'm wiser than anyone else. It was revealed so that you could be told the meaning, and so that you would know your innermost thoughts. Your majesty, you had a vision. You saw a large statue. This statue was very bright. It stood in front of you and it looked terrifying. The head of the statue was made of fine gold. Its chest and its arms are made of silver. Its stomach and hips, or belly and thighs, I think is a better translation, were made of bronze. Its legs were made of iron. Its feet were made partly of iron and partly of clay. While you were watching, a stone was cut out, not by humans. It struck the statue's iron and clay feet, and it smashed them. Then all at once, the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were smashed. They became like husks on a threshing floor in summer. The wind carried them away, and not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the statue became a large mountain which filled the whole world. This is the dream." And by this time, Nebuchadnezzar was nodding. "Now we will tell you its meaning. Your majesty, you are the greatest king. The God of heaven has given you the kingdom. He has given you power, strength, and honor. He has given you control over people, wild animals, and birds, wherever they live. He's made you ruler of them all. You are the head of gold." So he's saying the Babylonian kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar himself, the head of gold. "Another kingdom inferior to yours will arise to power after you. Then there will be a third kingdom, a kingdom of bronze that will rule the whole world. There will also be a fourth kingdom. It will be as strong as iron. Iron smashes and shatters it. As iron crashes things, this fourth kingdom will smash and crush all the other kingdoms. You also saw the feet and the toes. They were partly potter's clay and partly iron. This means there will be a divided kingdom which has some of the firmness of iron. As you saw, iron was mixed with clay. The toes were partly iron and partly clay. Part of the kingdom will be strong and part will be brittle. As you saw, iron is mixed with clay, so that two parts of the kingdom will mix by intermarrying, but they will not hold together any more than iron can mix with clay. At the time of those kings, the God of heaven will establish a kingdom that will never be destroyed. No other people will be permitted to rule it. It will smash all the other kingdoms and put an end to them. It will be established forever. This is the stone that you saw cut from a mountain, but not by humans. It smashed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has told you what will happen in the future, your majesty. The dream is true, and you can trust that this is the meaning." So Nebuchadnezzar accepted all this, and because this is basically the motherboard of most of the prophecy for the end times, one has to understand exactly what it's talking about. You've got Babylon is the head, the thinking part, and then after Babylon you've got the Medo-Persian Empire. You've got two arms, you've got the Medes, you've got the Persians together, and I think usually you have the statue of cross together. That's the Medo-Persian Empire. After that you've got the belly and the thighs of brass. That is the Greek Empire. And as I've explained on another occasion, the Greek Empire started under Alexander the Great, immediately split four ways after his death. But there were two main players. There was Ptolemy in the south, and the other one, Seleucus, in the north. They were the king of the south and the king of the north. Basically, it split in half. So you got two legs, even starting in Greek times. And then you had the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was always sort of two-pronged, even before it split. The western half, you had basically everybody spoke Latin. It was very western. Eastern half, the educated people spoke Greek, but it was all under Rome. And then it split. Of course, you had the Eastern Roman Empire, and you had the Western Roman Empire. And then later on, of course, Eastern Roman Empire was taken over by Islam, and the Western Roman Empire was taken over by Catholicism. So you've still got the two legs. And then coming to the end times, you've got the feet of iron and the feet of clay. Now, so that's basically the motherboard which fits all this prophecy to. And all the animals, basically, that you find in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8 and I think Daniel 11, I think, and of course Revelation, they all fit to this upright figure. Now, just to continue the story that I was telling about this German soldier, Michael Hasel's grandfather, he was sitting down in front of his commanding officer, and he turned to Daniel 2 and he explained all this to Daniel 2, and he said, "I think that Herr Hitler is wrong. We are not going to win this war, because we are now in the time the feet of the iron and clay, and it's going to be smashed. That we are not going to have a third 1,000-year Reich. We are going to lose this war." So the commanding officer said, thank you, Hasel. Do you mind if I borrow your Bible overnight and come back at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning?" So he went back, presumably, and prayed. Following morning, he goes into the colonel's office. Two other men sitting next to him. So he thinks, "Well, I've been betrayed. You know, I'm going to be shot. Because, you know, the penalty for not believing that Hitler was going to win is basically death." So he said, "No, sit down." And the commander explained the rule to these other two officers. So they all took their hats off. Hasel took his hat off. And he says, "Right, now go through it again." So he went through Daniel 2 again. And every so often, you know, the three officers would be talking and they'd be nodding. And at the end, the commander said, thank you very much, you're dismissed," and he gave him his Bible back. And he said, "Oh, by the way, before you go, I want to introduce these two men. They are both professors of history. They were high-up professors of history before they joined the German army. And they've agreed with every word you've said." And what happened after that was the commander squirreled every single bit of petrol, he rationed it, every bit of petrol, every bit of food, whatever he could get together to save his unit. But he, even in spite of that, because he knew that, that when they surrendered, they'd all have to go into captivity with the Russians. So, but of that unit of 1,200 people, seven people survived. Seven survived, including, of course, his grandfather. And the other odd thing about it was this man was a pacifist. For all the war, he carried a toy revolver on him, because he said, "I'm not going to kill anybody," so he carried a toy revolver. I know when my dad was on exercises, he used to have a toy revolver, because if he lost his revolver, of course it's a court-martial offence. So if you lose a toy, it doesn't really matter. But during a war, this man had a toy revolver in his holster for the whole war. Nobody knew about it. As I've explained, all the animals in Daniel 7, Daniel 8, and in Revelation, they link into this figure, you know, of the great image. And I think I've got time to zero in on just one of these animals. I want to zero in on the Persian Empire and on Cyrus in particular, because anyway, I'd like to, let me see, let's put my glasses on. Cyrus is a very, very interesting character. He is mentioned by God several times. In fact, the last words of the last verses of the Hebrew Bible mention him. If you'd like to turn to 2 Chronicles 36, verse 22. First, in the first year that Cyrus of Persia was emperor, the Lord made what he had said through the prophet Jeremiah come true. He prompted Cyrus to issue the following command and sent it out in writing to be read aloud everywhere in his empire. This is the command of Cyrus, king of Persia. The Lord, the God of heaven, has made me ruler over the whole world and has given me the responsibility of building a temple for him in Jerusalem, in Judah. Now, all of you who are God's people, go there, and may the Lord your God be with you. So the last words in the Hebrew, in the inspired, originally inspired order, talked about Cyrus. And Isaiah 44:28, if you want to look that up. That's about Cyrus. He is my shepherd. I'm going to come back to this verse later. He will do everything I want him to do. He says about Jerusalem, it will be rebuilt. He said about the temple, your foundation will be laid. Now how does one talk about Cyrus? You all heard about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon at the time, and he took a wife from the Median royal family. Just as today, most of the royal families in Europe are connected by marriage. You know, the Russian, even royal families that are extinct, all connected. It's the same in the ancient world. The Babylonian royal family, the Median, the Persian, the Lydian, they were all connected. So Nebuchadnezzar, he took his queen from the royal family of the Medes. It's very much, if you're thinking about where Media, just think of Iran and sort of go northwest, sort of northwestern bit of Iran, mountainous bit, that's the Medes. So she was very homesick. She loved her mountains, and we went to Babylon, it's flat, the whole area is flat. So Nebuchadnezzar, who wasn't all bad, actually built her a mountain. I don't know how he did it. Basically, he built her a mountain, which is called the Hanging Garden of Babylon. I think some of it's still there to this day. But now, this woman was the sister of the king of the Medes. His name was Astyages. Now Astyages had a son and a daughter, and he had a dream one night that his daughter would produce a son who would topple him off his throne. So he thought, well, what do I do? He said, okay, well, I'll marry her off to Cambyses of Persia. He's basically spends all his time in the library. He's not interested in world conquest. He'll just, you know, just get on with it. And so he married his daughter off to the king of the Persians, just got her out of the way. And they produced a son, Cambyses, and his daughter, got no name, but it doesn't matter. But, and Cyrus was the name of the son. And then when the king heard that Cyrus was born, he got his when Astyages found that Cyrus had been born, he told Harpagus, his commander-in-chief of his army, I want you to go and kill Cyrus. So he went off, but he didn't have a stomach to do the job, so he gave the job to a local shepherd. Now this shepherd had just lost his son, who was exactly the same age as Cyrus. So the shepherd gave Harpagus his own dead son, which he presented to Astyages, and he brought Cyrus up as his own. Now after 10 years, King Astyages found out that Cyrus was still alive. So he went to the Magi and said, what do I do? And the Magi said, on no account must you do anything to this boy, or there'll be big, big trouble. You must not touch that boy. So he didn't. But, well, just, he had Harpagus' son killed in revenge because he hadn't killed Cyrus in the first place. And I won't go into all the details because, you know, it's bad. Janice knows the details. But he had Harpagus' son killed. Now, Cyrus was about 10 at this point. Now, a few years later, Cyrus became effectively the king of the Persians, and he rebelled against the Medes, Astyages. Now Harpagus, Astyages' chief of staff, you know, commanding up, he went over to Cyrus, lock, stock, dock and barrel, and Cyrus took over the entire empire. Now, I'll go into the rest later. But the point is, as Isaiah 44:28 says, he says about Cyrus, he is my shepherd. Cyrus was brought up as a shepherd. And you know, I've worked with sheep. You have to know when to be firm and when to be soft. You know, it's a delicate, there's a lot to be learned from working with sheep. And it's a perfect job. I mean, King David, of course, he was a shepherd. And so Cyrus knew how to handle people and how to handle sheep. So Cyrus went on, and he went on and captured Lydia, which Lydia was the basically, you're talking about Turkey. And then he went on and he took Babylon. And when he got Babylon, all the slaves were freed. And the Jews were allowed to go back to Israel, to Judah. As I said, in the first year of Cyrus, 2 Chronicles 36, 20, in the first year that Cyrus of Persia was emperor, the Lord made what he had said through the prophet Jeremiah come true. He prompted Cyrus to issue the following command. This is the command of Cyrus, emperor of Persia. The Lord, the God of heaven, has made me ruler over the whole earth and has given me the responsibility of building a temple for him in Jerusalem, in Judah. Now all of you who are God's people, go there and may the Lord your God be with you. So Cyrus knew that Creator God had made him the ruler and that he'd given him the responsibility of rebuilding this temple, which is quite a responsibility, and he knew about it and he accepted it and he did it. But unfortunately, God also gives everybody free choice. You can either do things God's way or you can do things your own way. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, when people get a lot of power, they also get big-headed about it. And Cyrus, unfortunately, met a sticky end because he got big-headed. Now, if you can picture Iran as it is, and Turkey, and Babylon, that was a Persian empire. Now, above that, from about the Danube, if you can picture a line from the Danube River all the way across to China, there were some loosely affiliated tribes known as the Scythians or Scythians. And there was one tribe in particular that was directly north of where Cyrus was, and they were the Massageti. If you can picture, you've got the Black Sea, you're looking opposite to me, you've got the Black Sea, and then over this way you've got the Caspian Sea, and then a little that way, and you've got the Aral Sea, that was the area where the Massageti were. And they had a king and a queen, and they were a Scythian tribe. Now, Cyrus wanted this area because it was very fertile, and he thought, well, God is on my side, everything I've done so far I've succeeded in. So he thought, well, there's an easy way of doing this, or there's a hard way. I know what. The king has just died, the queen, I know what, I'll propose to her and I'll get her kingdom as well. So her husband had just died. Cyrus heard that she was beautiful. Apparently she was. But she was also a bit of a valley girl. She was very feisty. So Cyrus thought, I like that. So he sent a message to this queen, Queen Tomiris, I think her name was. Said, will you marry me? And, we'll rule this empire together. So Tomiris very sweetly said, on your bike, in diplomatic language, on your bike, or whatever they said in those days. So Cyrus said, well, that's no good, I'm going to take the empire anyway. So he got all his troops together, and they were about to cross the river, I think it was the Oxus River, it's a bit north of him. So the queen sent him a message and says, look, okay, I know you're not interested in me, I know you're interested in my kingdom, but could you just, you rule your people and try and put up with the fact that I'm ruling my people. She said, well, I know that you're not going to listen to a word I'm saying, so tell me, how do you want to play this? And do I come to you, or are you coming to me? If you want to come to me, I'll withdraw 3 days' march and we'll have the battle there. If we're going to have the on your home ground, then I'll come over to you. So Cyrus said, well, what do I do? So basically the Lydian said, well, take a leaf out of my book. I should have come to you and tried to have done battle your end. As it was, I allowed you to come to me, and you absolutely hammered me. So what I suggest is you go into her territory, and then you just carry on when you beat me. So Cyrus said, okay. So Cyrus told her, I'm coming into your territory. So she said, fine. Now Cyrus he prepared this great big camp, Persian camp, and he knew that they didn't have They didn't know what alcohol was, this Charlie. So he arranged for this camp to be captured. And all the soldiers would get this alcohol and they'd drink themselves into oblivion, and then Cyrus would attack them. And that's what happened. So, and one of the people who was captured was Tamaris' son, the queen's son. And when he woke up, he was so ashamed, he committed suicide. So the queen said, right, that's it. And she slaughtered practically every single Persian that she could find, including Cyrus. And he came to a very sticky end. So I suppose the lesson here is that when God has his servants, and as long as we remain humble, he can use us. As soon as we decide to get a bit above ourselves, he'll back off and just let us face the consequences. Now, anyway, I thought I'd throw that in because I've always been interested in Cyrus. But the main point of this is Daniel 2 is basically the motherboard of a prophecy. Everything else seems to hang onto Daniel 2 in some way or another. And I'll leave you with that. Thanks. Right.